Welcome to our deep dive into economics, where we're going to kind of look at how these big picture concepts actually play out right in your neighborhood. We've got some textbook excerpts, we've got some real-world scenarios, and really the whole goal is to get you to think and act locally when it comes to your economic choices.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me how economics can empower you to make a difference, right, in your community. And today we're going to be really exploring the building blocks of economics so you can start to see these principles at work in your own life.
Okay, so let's start with a basic question. What does economics really study? Is it all about money and stock markets, or is there something a little bit more to it?
Well, those are certainly parts of the economic landscape, but economics at its core is about understanding choices, really. It's about how individuals, businesses, and even entire societies make decisions in a world where resources are limited.
So it's about more than just money.
Absolutely. Economics goes beyond just dollars and cents. It's about understanding how we use our limited time, energy, and resources to achieve our goals. I mean, think about it like this. Even if you had all the money in the world, you'd still only have 24 hours in a day. You'd still have to choose how to spend those hours, what activities to pursue, and what to prioritize.
That makes sense. Yeah, it's about those everyday choices we make, even if we don't realize we're doing economics in the process, right?
Exactly. From deciding what to have for dinner to choosing a career path, we're constantly weighing those costs and benefits and really trying to get the most out of the resources we have.
So how does this idea of thinking and acting locally tie into all of this? Economics, I mean, it often seems like this big global thing that's just beyond our control.
It's true that global forces are definitely at play, but remember, global trends, they start with local actions. What's fascinating is that every purchase you make, every business you support, every local initiative you get involved with, it all contributes to the economic fabric of your community.
So it's like those butterfly effect scenarios, right? Where a small action can have those ripple effects that extend way beyond the immediate situation.
Precisely. Your choices as a consumer, a worker, and just a member of your community, they all contribute to the overall economic health and vitality of your local area.
Okay, I see the connection. But what about those big economic challenges we hear about all the time, like inflation, government debt, the business cycle? How can we think and act locally when it comes to those massive issues?
That's where understanding the building blocks of economics becomes so powerful. Let's start with scarcity, that fundamental concept in economics.
Okay, so remind us, what is scarcity and how does it play out in our everyday lives?
Scarcity simply means we have unlimited wants and needs, but limited resources to satisfy them. Think about your own life for a second. You probably have a list of things you'd like to buy, places you want to travel, experiences you'd love to have, but you're constrained by your income, time, and energy, right?
Yeah, that's definitely true. Who wouldn't want a private jet or vacation home in Bali? But my bank account and my vacation days say, no way.
Exactly. And that's the essence of scarcity.
Right.
It forces us to make choices, to prioritize some wants over others, to make trade-offs, and to be mindful of how we allocate our resources.
So how does this idea of scarcity play out locally?
Think about your local community. There are limited resources, land, labor, capital, and those resources, they have to be allocated somehow among all these competing uses. Your city council, for example, has to decide if they want to invest in a new park, a new school, or maybe improve public transportation.
It's like that old saying, you can't have your cake and eat it too. There are always trade-offs.
Exactly. And that's where economics comes in. It gives us a framework for understanding those trade-offs, making informed decisions, and allocating resources in a way that ideally maximizes well-being.
Okay, so scarcity forces us to make choices. And those choices, they have consequences for us personally and for the community as a whole. But how can we as individuals make better choices, particularly when we think locally?
Well, this is where that concept of opportunity cost comes in. Every choice you make means you're foregoing something else. So let's say you spend your Saturday afternoon at the mall. The opportunity cost could be going for a hike in a local park or volunteering at a community garden.
So it's not just about the money I spend, it's about what I'm not doing with my time and resources.
Precisely. And when you start thinking about opportunity costs, you become more mindful of your choices. You might decide that supporting that new local bookstore is worth skipping that trip to the big chain store across town, for example.
I see how that think local mindset starts to shift your priorities. But doesn't economics say that people are basically motivated by self-interest? How does that fit in with this idea of acting for the good of the community?
That's a great question. And it gets to the heart of how economists view human behavior. while we often act in our own self-interest, that doesn't mean we're solely driven by greed. In fact, our self-interest can often align with the well-being of others.
Okay, I'm intrigued. How does that work?
Think about a local farmer's market. The farmers are there selling their produce because they want to earn a living, right? That's in their self-interest. But by doing so, they're also providing fresh, healthy food to their community. They're supporting local agriculture. And they're reducing the environmental impact of transporting food from far away.
So in a way, their self-interest is tied to the interests of the community. It's like a win-win situation.
Exactly. And this is where that concept of voluntary exchange comes in. In a free market, people engage in these transactions because they believe they'll be better off as a result. The farmer gets to earn a living. The consumer gets that fresh local produce.
So it's not a zero-sum game where one person wins and the other loses.
Not at all. Trade, when it's voluntary and honest, creates value for both parties involved. And this is just as true at the local level.
Okay, so I'm seeing how these economic principles, scarcity, opportunity cost, and voluntary exchange, can inform our think and act locally mindset. But let's get specific. How can we as individuals apply these ideas to make a difference in our communities?
One powerful way is to support local businesses. Every time you choose to shop at a local bookstore, dine at a locally owned restaurant, or buy produce from a local farmer, you're making a vote with your dollars.
So it's like casting a ballot for the kind of community we want to live in.
Exactly. By supporting local businesses, you're helping to create jobs, keep that money circulating within the community, and preserve that unique character and vitality of your neighborhood.
It's like we're all investors in our own community's success. But what about those times when we just can't find everything we need locally? I mean, not every town has a microchip factory or a five-star hotel.
That's where understanding those benefits of specialization and trade comes in. No individual, business, or community can produce absolutely everything they need or want.
Yeah, it'd be pretty chaotic if everyone tried to grow their own food, build their own houses, and make their own clothes.
Exactly. And then this is where specialization comes in. By focusing on what we're good at producing, we can increase efficiency, lower costs, and create a much wider variety of goods and services for everyone to enjoy.
So it's like that old saying, jack of all trades, master of none. It's better to specialize in what you're good at and then trade with others for the things you need.
Precisely. And this principle applies at the local level as well. Your community might specialize in certain industries or products, and by trading with other communities, it can access that wider range of goods and services.
So it's not about trying to be completely self-sufficient. It's about recognizing the interconnectedness of communities and the benefits of specialization and trade.
You got it. And this interconnectedness, that's what creates economic growth and prosperity.
This is fascinating. I'm starting to see how understanding these seemingly abstract economic principles can actually empower us to make a real difference right here in our own communities.
Exactly. And the more we understand about these principles, the better equipped we'll be to make those informed choices that benefit both ourselves and our communities.
Okay, so we've covered scarcity, opportunity cost, voluntary exchange, and the benefits of specialization in trade. We've also talked about how these principles can inform our think and act locally mindset. But let's dive a bit deeper into the role of money in all of this. I mean, money seems to be like the lifeblood of any economy, but what exactly is it and how does it work?
Well, money, it acts as that medium of exchange. It makes it much easier to buy and sell goods and services than bartering. Can you imagine trying to trade your plumbing services for a haircut? It'd be a logistical nightmare.
Yeah, I could see how that would get complicated pretty quickly. So money simplifies those transactions and makes it easier for people to specialize and trade with each other.
Precisely. And this increased specialization leads to greater efficiency and productivity, which ultimately benefits everyone in the economy.
So money is more than just those bills in our wallets or the numbers in our bank accounts. It's a tool that facilitates trade, specialization, and ultimately economic growth.
Exactly. And it's particularly interesting to think about how money flows within a local economy. When you spend money at a local business, those dollars don't just disappear, they circulate within the community. They support jobs, generate income, and stimulate further economic activity.
It's like that ripple effect we were talking about earlier. But how can we be more mindful of those ripples when it comes to our spending habits?
One way is to think about where you're spending your money. Are you supporting local businesses whenever possible? Are you choosing products and services that are produced or manufactured locally? These choices might seem small, but they can have a pretty significant impact on your local economy.
So it's like those buy local campaigns, but with a deeper understanding of the economic principles at play.
Exactly. When you choose to spend your money locally, you're not just making a purchase, you're making an investment in your community.
I love that. It's like we're all shareholders in our local economy, and our spending decisions are like votes for the kind of community we want to create.
You got it. And the more we understand about these economic principles, the more empowered we become to make choices that benefit both ourselves and our communities.
This is really eye-opening. I'm starting to see economics in a whole new light, not just as some dry subject in a textbook, but as a powerful tool for understanding the world around us and making a difference right here at home.
That's what's so fascinating about economics. It's not just about these abstract theories. It's about real people making real choices that have real consequences. And when we understand those principles, we can make choices that create a more prosperous and fulfilling world for ourselves and our communities.
Okay, so we've explored the basics of scarcity, opportunity cost, voluntary exchange, and the role of money. We've also talked about how these principles can inform our think and act locally mindset. But let's shift gears a bit and talk about another key player in the economic game: businesses. What role do businesses play in shaping the economic landscape of a community?
Oh, businesses, they are essential. They're the engines of job creation, innovation, and economic growth. And at the local level, businesses play a particularly important role in shaping that character and vitality of a community.
So it's not just about those big corporations and multinational conglomerates. Local businesses are also key players.
Absolutely. Small businesses in particular are the backbone of most local economies. They provide jobs, they generate income, and they offer that wide range of goods and services that meet the needs of the community.
Okay, so local businesses are important, but what can they do to contribute to a thriving local economy?
Well, one of the most important things is to create good-paying jobs with benefits. When employees earn a living wage and they have access to health care, retirement savings plans, and paid time off, they're more likely to spend that money locally, which boosts the overall economy.
It's like a virtuous cycle, where businesses that invest in their employees create a more prosperous community, which in turn benefits those businesses.
Exactly. It's a win-win situation that fosters economic growth, social stability, and a higher quality of life for everyone.
I love it. So businesses can think and act locally by creating good-paying jobs and investing in their employees' well-being. But what about supporting other local businesses? I mean, can't businesses just focus on their own success and let the chips fall where they may?
You know, that's a very short-sighted approach. When businesses support each other, it creates what we call a multiplier effect that benefits the entire community.
Okay, explain that a bit more. How does this multiplier effect work?
Let's say a local restaurant decides to source its ingredients from local farms and producers. This creates demand for those local businesses, which in turn supports their employees and suppliers. Those employees and suppliers then have more money to spend in the local economy, which creates a ripple effect that boosts businesses throughout the community.
It's like that saying, a rising tide lifts all boats. When businesses support each other, the entire community benefits.
Precisely. And this interconnectedness, that's what creates a truly thriving local economy.
So it's about recognizing that we're all in this together, that the success of one business is intertwined with the success of others in the community.
Exactly. When local businesses work together, it creates a stronger, more resilient, and more prosperous economy for everyone.
I love this idea. It's about creating a community of businesses, not just a collection of individual competitors.
You got it. And the sense of community, this is what makes thinking and acting locally so powerful. It's about recognizing that we're all part of something bigger than ourselves and that our individual choices and actions can make a real difference.
This is so inspiring. I'm starting to see how economics, far from being this dry and abstract subject, can actually be a force for good, a tool for building stronger communities and creating a more prosperous and fulfilling world for everyone.
That's what's so exciting about economics. It's not just about numbers and graphs. It's about people, choices, and the consequences of those choices. And when we understand those principles, we can make choices that create a more just, sustainable, and thriving world for ourselves and future generations.
Okay, so we've explored the role of businesses in shaping the economic landscape of a community. But let's shift gears again and talk about another crucial player, the government. I mean, what role does government play in fostering a thriving local economy? Some people think government should just get out of the way and let the free market do its thing, while others believe government intervention is essential for ensuring fairness and stability. Where do you stand on this?
Well, the role of government in the economy is a complex and often debated issue. And while there are valid arguments on both sides, I believe that government can play a constructive role in fostering a thriving local economy, particularly when it focuses on creating a level playing field, investing in public goods, and addressing market failures.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Let's break that down. What do you mean by creating a level playing field?
A level playing field means ensuring that everyone has a fair chance to succeed, regardless of their background or circumstances. This can involve things like enforcing anti-discrimination laws, protecting property rights, and providing access to education and job training.
So it's about making sure the rules of the game are fair, and that everyone has an equal opportunity to participate.
Exactly. When the government creates a level playing field, it fosters competition, innovation, and economic growth.
Okay, that makes sense. But what about investing in public goods? What are public goods, and why is it the government's responsibility to provide them?
Public goods are things that benefit everyone in society, but that are difficult or impossible to provide through the private market. Examples include things like national defense, public safety, clean air and water, and basic infrastructure like roads and bridges.
I can see how it would be hard for a private company to profit from providing like national defense or clean air. But why is it the government's job to provide these things? Why can't individuals or communities just take care of themselves?
That's a good question, and it gets to the heart of what we call market failures. Sometimes the free market doesn't allocate resources efficiently. It leads to underproduction or overproduction of certain goods and services. Public goods are a classic example of this because they're what we call non-excludable, meaning it's really difficult to prevent people from benefiting from them even if they don't pay, and non-rivalrous, meaning one person's consumption doesn't diminish the availability for others. There's little incentive for those private companies to provide them.
So if I build a road, everyone can use it, whether they contributed to the cost or not, and me using the road doesn't prevent you from using it as well.
Exactly. And that's why the government often steps in to provide these public goods. They can collect taxes from everyone who benefits and ensure that these essential services are available for all.
Okay, so the government plays a role in creating a level playing field and investing in those public goods. What about addressing market failures? What other kinds of market failures are there, and how can the government address them?
Another common market failure is what we call externalities. Externalities are the costs or benefits of an economic activity that spill over onto third parties who are not directly involved in that transaction.
Okay, can you give me an example of that?
Pollution is a classic example of a negative externality. When a factory pollutes the air or water, it imposes costs on the surrounding community, right? Health problems, environmental damage, reduced property values.
So the factory is benefiting from producing its goods, but is also imposing costs on others who aren't part of the transaction.
Exactly. And this is where the government can step in to correct that market failure. It can impose regulations such as pollution limits or emissions taxes to internalize those costs and encourage the factory to reduce its pollution.
So it's about making sure that the polluter pays for the damage they're causing.
Precisely. And this is an important principle for ensuring a fair and sustainable economy.
Okay, so we've talked about how the government can create a level playing field, invest in public goods, and address those market failures.
Mm-hmm.
But what about those who argue that government intervention is inherently inefficient and that the free market is always the best solution?
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond to those arguments?
Well, while I believe in the power of markets, I also recognize that markets are not perfect. They can fail to allocate resources efficiently, and this can lead to problems like pollution, inequality, and economic instability.
So it's not about government versus markets. It's about finding the right balance between the two.
Exactly. The key is to find that sweet spot where government intervention is targeted, effective, and accountable.
Okay, so it's about using the power of government wisely and judiciously to address those areas where the market falls short.
Precisely. And this is particularly important at that local level where government policies and programs can have a direct impact on the lives of residents and the economic vitality of the community.
Okay, so we've talked about the role of government in fostering a thriving local economy, but let's bring it back to our theme of think and act locally. What can we as individuals do to make a difference when it comes to government and the economy?
One of the most important things is to stay informed and engaged in the political process. Attend those town hall meetings, write to your elected officials, and participate in local organizations that are working to promote economic opportunity and well-being in your community.
So it's about being more than just voters. It's about being active citizens who are informed and engaged in the issues that affect our communities.
Exactly. And it's about recognizing that government policies and programs don't just happen in a vacuum. They are the result of decisions made by real people. And our voices and actions can influence those decisions.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive into economics, from the fundamental principles of scarcity and choice to the role of businesses and government in shaping that economic landscape. We've also talked about how these principles can inform our think and act locally mindset. But let's shift gears one last time for part one and talk about a concept that's often associated with greed and excess profit. What exactly is profit, and what role does it play in a healthy economy?
You know, profit often gets a bad rap, but in a market economy, it actually plays a crucial role. It's the reward that entrepreneurs earn for taking those risks, innovating, and creating goods and services that people value.
So it's not just about lining the pockets of CEOs. There's actually a deeper purpose to profit.
Absolutely. Profit serves as a signal. It tells entrepreneurs what consumers want and need. When a business is profitable, it means it's creating value for its customers. It justifies its use of those scarce resources.
I see what you mean. If a business isn't profitable, it's a sign that it's not meeting a need in the market, and those resources could be better used elsewhere.
Precisely. And this is why profit is so important for a dynamic and innovative economy.
Okay, I'm starting to see profit in a new light. But how does this concept of profit connect to our think and act locally theme?
Well, when local businesses are profitable, they're more likely to reinvest in their communities. They hire more employees, they expand their operations, and they contribute to the overall economic vitality of the area.
So by supporting profitable local businesses, we're indirectly contributing to the economic well-being of our communities.
Exactly. It's a win-win. You get the goods and services that you need, and your community benefits from the economic activity that's generated by those profitable businesses.
This is fascinating. It's like we're all interconnected in this economic ecosystem, and our choices as consumers, workers, and citizens can have a ripple effect that extends far beyond those immediate transactions.
You got it. And the more we understand about economics, the more empowered we become to make choices that benefit both ourselves and our communities.
Yeah, it really is amazing how seemingly small individual choices can kind of contribute to those larger economic forces. And it brings us to, well, the fascinating and sometimes controversial topic of competition. Some people see competition as this cutthroat, ruthless thing, while others view it as the driving force behind innovation and progress. Where do you kind of stand on this debate?
Well, I've always kind of thought that competition was a good thing. You know, it kind of keeps businesses on their toes and forces them to offer, you know, better products and services and at lower prices, hopefully. But I can also see how competition can sometimes lead to like some pretty nasty behavior, you know, companies trying to undercut each other or even sabotage their rivals.
Yeah, it's true. Competition can definitely have both positive and negative aspects. But in a market economy, competition is generally seen as a force for good. It encourages businesses to innovate, to improve their efficiency, and to offer those products and services that meet the needs of consumers. Okay, so how does this work in practice? Can you give me a concrete example of how competition actually benefits consumers at that local level?
Sure. Let's say there are two coffee shops in your town.
Okay.
Both offer similar products. You've got your coffee, your pastries, maybe some sandwiches. Initially, they might charge similar prices and offer a similar level of service. But competition will likely push them to find ways to, you know, differentiate themselves and attract customers.
So they might start offering different types of coffee, maybe a wider selection of pastries, or even like start hosting live music events.
Exactly. Competition incentivizes businesses to innovate, to experiment, and to find new ways to create value for their customers. And this benefits those consumers by giving them more choices, better products, and often lower prices.
So competition is like this invisible hand that guides businesses towards meeting the needs of consumers, even if those businesses are like primarily motivated by profit.
You got it. And this is why economists generally view competition as a good thing. It creates a much more dynamic, efficient, and responsive marketplace.
Okay, I'm starting to see the power of competition. But what about those downsides? I mean, competition can get pretty intense, even cutthroat at times. How do we ensure the competition doesn't devolve into something destructive?
Yeah, that's where things get a bit more complex. While competition is generally beneficial, it's important to ensure that it's fair, you know, and that businesses aren't engaging in unethical or illegal practices just to gain an advantage.
So we need some rules of the game, some guardrails to prevent competition from spiraling out of control.
Exactly. That's where government regulations and antitrust laws come in. These laws aim to prevent monopolies, price fixing, and other anti-competitive practices that harm consumers and stifle innovation.
Okay, I see how that makes sense. But what about the role of consumers in all of this? I mean, we're the ones who ultimately decide which businesses succeed and which ones fail. How can we as consumers use our economic power to, like, promote healthy competition and support businesses that are doing things the right way?
That's a great question. And it gets to the heart of what it means to think and act locally as a consumer. Your choices matter. Every purchase you make is a vote for the kind of businesses you want to see thrive in your community.
So it's not just about finding the lowest price or the most convenient option. We should also consider, like, the ethics and practices of those businesses we support.
Absolutely. When you choose to patronize businesses that are committed to things like fair labor practices, environmental sustainability, and ethical sourcing, you're sending a powerful signal. You're telling those businesses that you value their approach and you're willing to support them with your dollars.
It's like we're casting a ballot with our wallets, voting for the kind of economic ecosystem we want to create.
Exactly. And this consumer activism can have this ripple effect, encouraging other businesses to adopt more ethical and sustainable practices as well.
So competition can be this powerful force for good, but it needs to be guided by ethical principles and those informed consumer choices. It's about creating an environment where businesses compete on the basis of quality, innovation, and value, not on who can cut the most corners or exploit the most workers.
You got it. And this is where that idea of thinking and acting locally becomes so important. It's about recognizing that our choices as consumers, they have consequences. And we can actually use our economic power to shape the kind of community we want to live in.
This is really empowering. I'm starting to see how understanding economics can help us not only navigate those complexities of the marketplace, but also make choices that align with our values and contribute to a more just and sustainable world.
That's the beauty of economics. It's not just about money and markets. It's about people, choices, and the impact those choices have on our lives and the lives of those around us.
Okay, so we've talked about competition and the role of consumers in shaping that marketplace. But let's zoom out a bit and talk about another key concept in economics: productivity. We hear a lot about productivity, particularly in the context of economic growth. But what exactly is productivity, and why is it so important?
Productivity is essentially, it's a measure of how efficiently we use our resources to produce goods and services. The more output we can generate from a given amount of input, the more productive we are.
So it's like getting more bang for our buck, squeezing more value out of those resources we have available.
Exactly. And productivity is a key driver of economic growth and prosperity. When we become more productive, we can produce more goods and services with that same amount of resources, meaning we can consume more, invest more, and raise our standard of living.
Okay, so productivity is important. But how can we think and act locally when it comes to something as seemingly abstract as productivity?
It starts with recognizing that productivity isn't just about working harder or longer hours. It's about working smarter, finding ways to improve our processes, invest in new technologies, and really enhance our skills.
So it's about innovation, creativity, and finding ways to do things more efficiently.
Exactly. And this applies at all levels, from individual workers to businesses to entire communities.
Okay, so give us some examples. How can individuals think and act locally to actually boost productivity in their communities?
Well, one way is to invest in education and training. By acquiring new skills and knowledge, individuals can become more valuable to those employers and contribute to a more productive workforce.
So it's about recognizing that our education doesn't end when we graduate from school. It's this ongoing process of lifelong learning and skill development.
Precisely. And this applies to everyone, regardless of their age or career stage.
Okay, so education and training are key. What about businesses? How can they think and act locally to enhance productivity?
Well, businesses can invest in new technologies and equipment that automate those tasks, streamline their processes, and increase their efficiency.
But wouldn't that lead to job losses? I mean, if machines are doing the work, what happens to those people who used to do those jobs?
That's a valid concern, and it's something that definitely needs to be addressed thoughtfully. But history has shown that technological advancements, while they might displace some jobs in the short term, they ultimately create new opportunities and lead to higher overall employment.
So it's like that creative destruction process where those old industries give way to new ones and new jobs emerge to replace those that are lost.
Exactly. The key is to adapt, to embrace new technologies, and to invest in that training and education that equips those workers with the skills they need to thrive in a rapidly changing economy.
So it's about being proactive, not reactive. It's about anticipating those changes and preparing ourselves and our communities for the future of work.
You got it. And this is where thinking and acting locally becomes so important. It's about recognizing that our communities are not immune to those larger economic forces, and that we need to be proactive in adapting, innovating, and investing in the future.
This is really inspiring. I'm starting to see how understanding economics can empower us to not only navigate those complexities of the marketplace, but also shape the future of our communities.
That's the power of economics. It's not just a set of theories or abstract concepts. It's a framework for understanding the world around us and making those informed choices that create a more prosperous and fulfilling future for everyone.
Okay, so we've talked about productivity and the importance of innovation, education, and those technological advancements. But let's shift gears again and talk about a topic that's often associated with economic inequality. Wealth. What exactly is wealth, and how is it different from income?
That's a great question, and it's one that often causes some confusion. Income is the flow of money that you receive over a period of time, such as your salary or wages. Wealth, on the other hand, is the stock of assets that you own. Your house, your car, your investments, your savings.
So income is like that water flowing into a bathtub, while wealth is the water that's already in the tub.
That's a great analogy. And just like a bathtub can only hold a certain amount of water, your wealth represents those accumulated assets, your financial reservoir, so to speak.
Okay, I see the difference between income and wealth, but why is wealth important? And how does it connect to our theme of thinking and acting locally?
Well, wealth is important because it provides financial security, it gives you options, and empowers you to make choices that align with your values. And at that local level, wealth creation is absolutely essential for a thriving community.
So it's not just about individuals accumulating wealth for themselves. It's about creating a community where wealth is generated and shared in a way that benefits everyone.
Precisely. When those individuals and businesses in a community are creating wealth, it generates economic activity, it supports jobs, and provides resources for investment in things like infrastructure, education, and social services.
Okay, I'm starting to see how wealth creation can be a positive force for that community. But what about that flip side, wealth inequality? We hear a lot about that growing gap between the rich and the poor. How does that play out at the local level, and what can we do about it?
Wealth inequality is a complex issue with multiple causes and consequences. And while there's no easy solution, there are things we can do at the local level to address those root causes and mitigate those negative effects.
Okay, so what are some of those things?
Well, one approach is to focus on education and job training. By providing everyone with the opportunity to acquire the skills and knowledge they need to succeed in that modern economy, we can create a more level playing field and reduce those income and wealth disparities.
So it's about investing in human capital, ensuring that everyone has the tools they need to thrive in the 21st century economy.
Exactly. And it's not just about that formal education. It's about creating a culture of lifelong learning and providing those opportunities for people to reskill and upskill throughout their careers.
Okay, so education and training are crucial. What else can we do to address wealth inequality at the local level?
Another important approach is to support policies that promote affordable housing, access to healthcare, and other essential services. When people are struggling to make ends meet, it's hard for them to save, invest, and build wealth.
So it's about creating a safety net that prevents people from falling through those cracks and provides that foundation for economic opportunity.
Exactly. And it's about recognizing that investing in the well-being of our communities is not just a moral imperative, it's an economic necessity as well.
Okay, so education, job training, affordable housing, and access to healthcare, those are all important pieces of that puzzle. Mm-hmm. But what about those who argue that wealth inequality is simply like a natural outcome of a market economy, and that any attempt to address it will just stifle innovation and growth? How do you respond to those arguments?
While I believe in the power of markets, I also recognize that markets aren't always fair or equitable. And when wealth becomes too concentrated at the top, it can create a host of problems. Reduced economic mobility, political instability, even social unrest.
So it's not about demonizing wealth or trying to eliminate inequality altogether. It's about finding ways to create a more inclusive and sustainable economy where everyone has that opportunity to prosper.
Precisely. And this is where thinking and acting locally becomes so important. It's about recognizing that we have the power to shape that economic landscape of our communities and to create a more just and equitable world for everyone.
This is really empowering. It's about recognizing that we're not just those passive recipients of economic forces. We're active participants who can shape those forces to create the kind of world we want to live in.
Exactly. And that's the beauty of economics. It's not just a set of theories or abstract concepts. It's a framework for understanding the world around us and making informed choices that create a more just, sustainable, and thriving world for ourselves and future generations.
Okay, so we've explored the concepts of wealth and wealth inequality, and we've talked about how we can think and act locally to address these issues. But let's dive into a topic that's on everyone's mind these days. Inflation. Prices seem to be rising for everything, and it's making it harder and harder to make ends meet. What exactly is inflation, and what can we do about it?
Well, inflation is a general increase in the prices of those goods and services in an economy over a period of time. When the price level rises, each unit of currency buys fewer goods and services. Consequently, inflation reflects a reduction in the purchasing power per unit of money, a loss of real value in the medium of exchange and unit of account within the economy.
So it's not just that things are getting more expensive, it's that our money is buying less.
Exactly. Imagine if you could buy a loaf of bread for a dollar last year, but now it costs $2. Your dollar is now worth half as much in terms of its ability to buy bread.
That makes sense. It's like our money is shrinking. But what causes inflation in the first place? Is it just greedy businesses raising prices?
While businesses can raise prices, that's not the root cause of inflation. It's a bit more nuanced than that. One of the primary drivers of inflation is an increase in the money supply. When there's more money circulating in the economy, but the amount of goods and services remains relatively constant, it can lead to higher prices.
So it's like too much money chasing too few goods.
Exactly. It's that classic case of supply and demand. When the demand for goods and services outpaces the supply, prices tend to rise.
Okay, so an increase in the money supply can lead to inflation. But who controls the money supply? Is it the government?
In most modern economies, the money supply is managed by what we call a central bank. In the United States, it's the Federal Reserve. Central banks have various tools at their disposal to influence that money supply, such as setting interest rates, buying or selling government bonds.
So the Federal Reserve can make more money appear, just like that.
Well, not exactly appear. It's a bit more complex than that. But they can create new money electronically and inject it into the economy through various mechanisms.
Okay, so the Federal Reserve has a lot of power when it comes to inflation. But how does this all connect to our theme of thinking and acting locally? I mean, it seems like inflation is this big macroeconomic issue that's beyond our control.
While we might not have direct control over monetary policy, understanding those forces that drive inflation can help us make more informed choices in our own lives.
Okay, so give us some examples. How can we think and act locally when it comes to inflation?
Well, one way is to be mindful of our spending habits. When prices are rising, it's important to prioritize those essential goods and services and to look for ways to save money. Maybe buy in bulk, shop for sales, and cut back on that discretionary spending.
So it's about being more intentional with our spending and finding ways to, like, stretch our dollars further.
Exactly. And it's about recognizing that even small changes in our spending habits can make a difference.
Okay, so being mindful of our spending is key. What else can we do to think and act locally when it comes to inflation?
Another important step is to support those local businesses. When you buy goods and services from local businesses, you're helping to keep those dollars circulating within your community, supporting local jobs, and reducing the impact of rising transportation costs.
So it's like creating a more resilient local economy that's less susceptible to the fluctuations of global markets.
Exactly. When you support those local businesses, you're not just making a purchase, you're making an investment in that economic health and vitality of your community.
I love that. It's about recognizing that our choices as consumers have power and that we can use that power to create a more sustainable and resilient local economy.
You got it. And it's about understanding that economics is not just some abstract theoretical concept. It's about real people making real choices that have real consequences. And when we understand those principles, we can make choices that create a more just, sustainable, and thriving world for ourselves and our communities.
This is really eye-opening. I'm starting to see how understanding economics can help us navigate those complexities of inflation and make choices that not only benefit ourselves, but also strengthen our local economies.
That's the beauty of economics. It's not just about numbers and graphs. It's about people, choices, and the impact those choices have on our lives and the lives of those around us.
Okay, so we've explored the concept of inflation and talked about how we can think and act locally to mitigate its effects. But let's shift gears again and talk about another topic that's often in the news, the stock market. For some, the stock market represents the epitome of capitalism, a place where fortunes are made and lost. But for many others, it's a mysterious and intimidating world that seems far removed from their everyday lives. So what exactly is the stock market, and how does it impact us at the local level?
Well, the stock market is essentially a marketplace where buyers and sellers come together to trade shares of ownership in publicly traded companies. These shares, also known as stocks or equities, they represent a portion of ownership in a company.
So when you buy a share of stock, you're buying a tiny piece of that company.
Exactly. And as a shareholder, you have the potential to profit from the company's success. If the company performs well and its stock price goes up, you can sell your shares for a profit.
Okay, so the stock market is a place where people buy and sell pieces of companies, hoping to make money. But how does this impact the economy, particularly at the local level?
The stock market plays this crucial role in facilitating that flow of capital, which is essential for economic growth. When companies issue stock, they're essentially raising money from investors that they can use to expand their operations, hire more employees, invest in research and development, and ultimately grow their businesses.
So it's like a giant crowdfunding platform, but for businesses.
That's a great analogy. And this flow of capital fueled by that stock market can have a pretty significant impact on local economies. When businesses grow and expand, they create jobs, generate income, and stimulate that economic activity in those communities where they operate.
Okay, I'm starting to see how the stock market can be this positive force for those local economies. But what about the flip side, the risks associated with that stock market? We hear those stories about people losing their life savings in stock market crashes. How can we think and act locally when it comes to something as volatile and potentially risky as the stock market?
Well, it's true that the stock market can be volatile, and there are inherent risks involved in investing. However, there are also ways to mitigate those risks and make informed decisions that align with your financial goals and risk tolerance.
Okay, so give us some tips. How can we think and act locally when it comes to the stock market?
One important principle is diversification. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Spread your investments across different asset classes, such as stocks, bonds, real estate, and commodities.
So it's like that old saying, don't bet the farm on one horse. It's about spreading your risk to create a more stable and resilient portfolio.
Exactly. And this principle of diversification can also be applied at that local level.
Okay, I'm intrigued. How so?
When you invest in a diversified portfolio that includes local businesses, real estate, and other community-based assets, you're not just seeking those financial returns, you're also contributing to that economic stability and growth of your area.
So it's like being a locavore, but for investments. Instead of just investing in those big multinational corporations, we can also invest in our own communities.
Exactly. And this approach can be particularly rewarding, both financially and personally.
Okay, I'm starting to see how the stock market, even though it might seem like this distant abstract thing, can actually have a real impact on our local economies and our own financial well-being.
You got it. And it all comes back to this idea of thinking and acting locally. It's about recognizing that our choices as investors, consumers, workers, and citizens have consequences, and that we can use our economic power to shape the kind of world we want to live in.
This is really inspiring. I'm starting to see how understanding economics can empower us to not only navigate those complexities of the marketplace, but also make choices that align with our values and contribute to a more just and sustainable world.
That's what's so exciting about economics. It's not just about money and markets. It's about people, choices, and the impact those choices have on our lives and the lives of those around us.
Okay, so we've explored that stock market and talked about how we can think and act locally when it comes to our investment decisions. But let's shift gears again and talk about a concept that often generates those heated debates: government intervention in the economy. Some people believe the government should play a minimal role, while others argue that government intervention is essential for ensuring fairness, stability, and economic opportunity. What's your take on this debate?
Well, the role of government in the economy is a complex issue with no easy answers. And while there are valid arguments on both sides, I believe that government can play this constructive role in fostering a thriving economy, particularly when it focuses on creating a level playing field, investing in those public goods, and addressing market failures.
Okay, we talked about those concepts before, but can you remind us what they mean and how they relate to government intervention?
Sure. Creating a level playing field means ensuring that everyone has a fair chance to succeed in that marketplace, regardless of their background or circumstances. This can involve things like enforcing those anti-discrimination laws, protecting intellectual property rights, and promoting competition by preventing those monopolies.
So it's about making sure the rules of the game are fair and that everyone has an equal opportunity to participate.
Exactly. When the government creates that level playing field, it fosters innovation, entrepreneurship, and economic growth.
Okay, that makes sense. But what about investing in those public goods? Can you remind us what public goods are and why it's often necessary for the government to provide them?
Sure. Public goods are things that benefit everyone in society, but are difficult or impossible to provide through the private market. Classic examples include national defense, public safety, clean air and water, and that basic infrastructure like roads and bridges.
Yeah, I can see how it would be hard for a private company to profit from providing, like, national defense or clean air.
Yeah.
But why is it the government's job to provide these things? Why can't individuals or communities just take care of themselves?
That's a good question, and it gets to the heart of what we call market failures. Sometimes the free market doesn't allocate those resources efficiently, leading to underproduction or overproduction of certain goods and services. Public goods are a classic example of this. Because they're what we call non-excludable, meaning it's really difficult to prevent people from benefiting from them, even if they don't pay, and non-rivalrous, meaning one person's consumption doesn't diminish the availability for others, there's little incentive for those private companies to provide them.
So if I build a road, everyone can use it, whether they contributed to that cost or not, and me using the road doesn't prevent you from using it as well.
Exactly. And that's why the government often steps in to provide those public goods. It can collect taxes from everyone who benefits, ensuring that those essential services are available to all.
Okay, so the government plays a role in creating a level playing field and investing in those public goods. What about addressing those market failures? What other kinds of market failures are there, and how can the government address them?
Another common market failure is what we call externalities. Externalities are those costs or benefits of an economic activity that spill over onto third parties who are not directly involved in that transaction.
Okay, can you give me an example of that?
Sure. Pollution is a classic example of a negative externality. When a factory pollutes the air or water, it imposes costs on that surrounding community in the form of health problems, environmental damage, and reduced property values.
So the factory is benefiting from producing its goods, but it's also imposing costs on others who aren't part of the transaction.
Exactly. And this is where the government can step in to correct that market failure. It can impose regulations such as pollution limits or emissions taxes to internalize those costs and encourage the factory to reduce its pollution.
So it's about making sure that the polluter pays for the damage they're causing.
Precisely. And this is an important principle for ensuring a fair and sustainable economy.
Okay, so we've talked about how the government can create a level playing field, invest in those public goods, and address those market failures. But what about those who argue that government intervention is inherently inefficient and that the free market is always the best solution? How do you respond to those arguments?
Well, while I believe in the power of markets, I also recognize that markets are not perfect. They can fail to allocate resources efficiently, leading to problems like pollution, inequality, and economic instability.
So it's not about government versus markets. It's about finding that right balance between the two.
Exactly. The key is to find that sweet spot where government intervention is targeted, effective, and accountable.
Okay, so it's about using the power of government wisely and judiciously to address those areas where the market falls short.
Precisely. And this is particularly important at that local level, where government policies and programs can have a direct impact on the lives of those residents and that economic vitality of the community.
Okay, so we've talked about that role of government in fostering a thriving local economy. But let's bring it back to our theme of think and act locally. What can we as individuals do to make a difference when it comes to government and the economy?
One of the most important things is to stay informed and engaged in the political process. Attend those town hall meetings, write to your elected officials, and participate in local organizations that are working to promote economic opportunity and well-being in your community.
So it's about being more than just voters. It's about being those active citizens who are informed and engaged in the issues that affect our community.
Exactly. And it's about recognizing that government policies and programs don't just happen in a vacuum. They are the result of decisions made by real people, and our voices and actions can influence those decisions.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive into economics, from those fundamental principles of scarcity and choice to the role of businesses in government in shaping that economic landscape. We've also talked about how these principles can inform our think and act locally mindset. But let's shift gears and explore the fascinating and often controversial world of international trade.
You know, international trade, despite those heated debates it sparks, it boils down to the same principles we've been discussing. People engaging in voluntary exchange to benefit themselves. It's just happening on a larger scale across national borders.
So instead of me trading, like, my homemade cookies for your gardening skills, we're talking about countries trading their specialized goods and services.
Exactly. One country might have an abundance of natural resources, another might excel in manufacturing, while another might specialize in technological innovation. By trading with each other, each country can access a wider range of goods and services than they could produce on their own.
Okay, that makes sense. But we often hear those arguments against international trade, particularly concerns about job losses and unfair competition. How do those arguments fit into this picture of, like, mutually beneficial exchange?
You know, those concerns are valid and important to address. However, the economic reality is that trade, when done freely and fairly, can actually lead to more jobs and greater prosperity for all involved.
Really? How does that work? It seems counterintuitive that opening ourselves up to competition from other countries would actually lead to more jobs here at home.
It's all about specialization and comparative advantage. When countries focus on producing the goods and services that they're most efficient at, they can produce more overall. This increased production leads to lower prices for consumers and greater efficiency in that global economy.
So it's like that coffee shop example we talked about, but on a global scale. Each country finds its niche and becomes really good at producing certain things, and then everyone benefits from trading with each other.
Exactly. And those lower prices and increased efficiency can actually lead to more jobs and higher incomes, even in countries that might initially lose jobs in certain industries.
Okay, I'm intrigued. How does that work in practice? Can you give me a concrete example of how trade can lead to more jobs, even if some jobs are initially lost?
Sure. Let's say a country specializes in manufacturing clothing. They become very efficient at producing high-quality clothing at low prices. Now they start trading with another country that specializes in producing electronics.
So the clothing-producing country can now buy those affordable electronics, and the electronics-producing country can buy affordable clothing.
Exactly. And this trade can lead to several positive outcomes. First, consumers in both countries benefit from those lower prices and greater variety. Second, that increased demand for clothing and electronics can lead to job growth in both countries, even if some jobs are initially lost in industries that are less competitive.
Okay, so trade can lead to lower prices, greater variety, and ultimately more jobs. But what about the argument that trade can be unfair, particularly when some countries have lower labor or environmental standards? How do we ensure that trade is conducted in a way that's both beneficial and ethical?
That's a crucial question. And it brings us to the importance of what we call fair trade practices. This involves ensuring that trade agreements include provisions that protect workers' rights, promote environmental sustainability, and prevent exploitation.
So it's not just about free trade, it's about fair trade.
Exactly. It's about creating this global trading system that benefits everyone, not just those at the top. And this is where consumers can play this really powerful role.
Okay, I'm interested. How can consumers think and act locally when it comes to international trade?
One way is to support businesses that are committed to those fair trade practices. Look for labels and certifications that indicate that the products you're buying were produced in a way that respects workers' rights, protects the environment, and promotes sustainable development.
So it's about being informed consumers and making choices that align with our values.
Precisely. Every purchase we make is a vote for the kind of world we want to live in. And by supporting those fair trade practices, we can contribute to a more just and sustainable global economy.
Okay, I'm starting to see how international trade, even though it might seem like this distant global issue, actually connects to our everyday choices and our think and act locally mindset.
You got it. It's all about recognizing that we're part of this global economy and that our choices as consumers have ripple effects that extend far beyond our local communities.
Okay, so we've explored those basics of international trade and the importance of fair trade practices. But let's shift gears one last time and talk about a concept that often generates a lot of fear and uncertainty: economic downturns. Those periods of recession or depression that can lead to those job losses, business failures, and widespread hardship. What causes these economic downturns, and what can we do to prepare for them and mitigate their impact?
Well, economic downturns are kind of a natural part of what we call the business cycle, the cyclical fluctuations in economic activity that characterize most modern economies.
So it's like the economy has its own seasons, with periods of growth and expansion, followed by those periods of contraction and recession.
That's a great analogy. And just like we prepare for the changing seasons by adjusting our clothing and activities, we can also prepare for those economic downturns by taking steps to strengthen our financial resilience and mitigate that potential impact on ourselves and our communities.
Okay, so give us some tips. How can we think and act locally when it comes to those economic downturns?
Well, one of the most important things is to manage our personal finances responsibly, right? This means living within our means, avoiding excessive debt, and building up that emergency fund that can cover several months of living expenses in case of job loss or those unexpected expenses.
So it's about being financially prepared for those rainy days, knowing that economic storms can happen unexpectedly.
Exactly. And it's not just about individual preparedness. We can also think and act locally by supporting policies and programs that strengthen that social safety net. Things like unemployment insurance, food assistance, and affordable health care.
So it's about creating a more resilient community where people have access to those resources they need to weather those economic storms.
Precisely. And it's about recognizing that we're all in this together. When our neighbors are struggling, it affects us all.
This is really eye-opening. I'm starting to see how understanding economics can empower us to not only navigate those complexities of the marketplace, but also build stronger, more resilient communities that can weather those inevitable economic downturns.
That's the power of economics. It's not just a set of theories or abstract concepts. It's about understanding those forces that shape our world and using that knowledge to make those informed choices that benefit both ourselves and our communities.
Okay, so we've talked about those economic downturns and the importance of financial resilience. But let's shift gears one last time and explore a concept that's often seen as the key to long-term economic growth and prosperity: innovation. What exactly is innovation, and how does it play out at that local level?
Innovation is the process of creating something new and valuable, whether it's a product, a service, a process, or even a new way of thinking. And at that local level, innovation is essential for driving economic growth, creating jobs, and improving our quality of life.
So it's not just about those big tech companies in Silicon Valley coming up with, like, the next iPhone or self-driving car. Innovation can happen anywhere and in any industry.
Absolutely. Innovation can happen in the smallest of towns and in the most traditional of industries. It's about finding new and better ways to do things, solving problems, and creating value for those customers.
Okay, so innovation is important. But how can we think and act locally when it comes to something as seemingly elusive as innovation? I mean, it's not like there's a magic formula for coming up with brilliant new ideas.
Yeah, while there's no magic formula, there are certain things we can do to kind of foster an environment that encourages innovation at the local level. One is to support a culture of entrepreneurship. This means creating a supportive ecosystem for those startups and small businesses, providing access to capital, mentorship, and resources that help them grow and thrive.
So it's about creating a fertile ground where those entrepreneurial seeds can be planted and flourish.
Exactly. And it's about celebrating risk-taking and embracing failure as that learning opportunity.
I love that. It's about creating a community where it's okay to try new things, to experiment, and to learn from our mistakes.
You got it. And this culture of entrepreneurship can be incredibly powerful for driving innovation at the local level.
Okay, so supporting entrepreneurship is key. What else can we do to think and act locally when it comes to innovation?
Another important step is to invest in education, particularly in those STEM fields: science, technology, engineering, and math. These are the fields that drive innovation and create those jobs of the future.
So it's about equipping our workforce with the skills and knowledge they need to compete in a global economy that's increasingly driven by technology and innovation.
Precisely. And it's not just about that formal education. It's about fostering a lifelong love of learning, encouraging curiosity, and providing opportunities for people of all ages to explore those new ideas and develop new skills.
Okay, so education is crucial. What else can we do to foster innovation at the local level?
Another important step is to create spaces and opportunities for collaboration and knowledge sharing. This can involve things like supporting local makerspaces, incubators, and those co-working spaces that bring together those entrepreneurs, creatives, and innovators from different backgrounds and disciplines.
So it's about creating those serendipitous encounters where people can cross-pollinate ideas and inspire each other.
Exactly. Innovation often happens at the intersection of different disciplines and perspectives. And when we create those spaces where those connections can happen organically, we increase the likelihood of those aha moments that lead to those breakthroughs.
I love that. It's about creating this vibrant ecosystem where innovation can flourish.
You got it. And this ecosystem can be incredibly powerful for driving economic growth, creating jobs, and improving our quality of life at that local level.
This is so inspiring. I'm starting to see how understanding economics can empower us to not only navigate those complexities of the marketplace, but also shape the future of our communities through innovation. But as we wrap up our deep dive, I have one final question. We've talked about a lot of economic concepts and principles, but what's that one big takeaway message you want our listeners to remember?
That economics is not just some abstract academic subject. It's a framework for understanding the world around us, for making those informed choices, and for creating a more prosperous, just, and sustainable world for ourselves and future generations. And it all starts right here, right now, with the choices we make in our own communities.
What a powerful message. It's about recognizing that we're not just passive recipients of economic forces, but those active participants who can shape those forces to create the kind of world we want to live in.
Exactly. And it's about remembering that economics is ultimately about human well-being. It's about using our knowledge, our creativity, and our collective action to build a world where everyone has that opportunity to thrive.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's deep dive. Thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
And remember, folks, the power to shape our economic future lies within each of us. So go out there and think and act locally. And together, let's create a more just, sustainable, and prosperous world for everyone.
Until next time, happy economizing.